Okay. So I'm told that the project 3 has also graded. I'll return all of them next class. In project 4, the material for project 4 is sort of going to be discussed today. Essentially, it's backward chaining theorem proving. Okay, that's what we're going to be discussing. So before I go forward, are there any questions? By the way, the drop at deadline is over. So I guess we are stuck unless you plan to withdraw from the entire semester. I plan to see you pretty much every day from now on, every class. Maybe every day if you're not doing well, you should come and talk to me. But anyway, so I am going to continue the discussion on first-order logic semantics, which we started talking about last time. I'm just going to repeat it once and then move on to proof theoretic inference. Okay. Are there any questions before I go forward? Okay. So we were mentioning essentially that the way you want to provide semantics, the model theoretic semantics for first order logic, is to think of it essentially as a shorthand notation for a propositional logical database. And since we know how to give model theoretic semantics for propositional logic database, because if you give a propositional logic database, then you essentially generate, you take all the proposition names, write a big truth table, and then talk about all the columns, one column corresponding to the set of theorems, all the axioms in the knowledge base being true, another column corresponding to the theorem that you're trying to prove, whether it's true or not. And if in every row where your knowledge base is true, every interpretation where the knowledge base is true, if the theorem is true, then you're done. Another way of doing it is you take theorem and make a column called theorem and negation of what it is that you're trying to prove, and it better have false, false, false everywhere. Right? So of course, this table is going to be essentially exponential in terms of the number of propositions. Okay, if you have n propositions, the table size would be 2 power n rows. Okay, so that was the basic idea. Now, of course, if I give you a first order logic database and if you can figure out a way of constructing an equivalent propositional logic database, right, then in essence you have provided model theoretic semantics for that too. And that's what we were discussing last time. Of course, the idea is to realize essentially that propositions correspond to, so in first order logic, you have these things called ground atomic sentences. Okay, an atomic sentence is a predicate of terms. Okay? And it would be called ground if there are no variables anywhere in these terms. Okay? And a term itself, of course, it is a constant, a variable, a function of terms. So function, a term itself is recursively defined as a constant is a term, a variable is a term, and a function of terms is a term. Okay? So of course, since I put ground, in essence, I don't want any variables in any of the terms. So if I consider all the ground atomic sentences that are present in my database, then I would say that each of the ground atomic sentences corresponds to a proposition. Essentially, it's an assertion of truth that would be the true or false in your world. It's a primitive assertion that will be true or false in the world. Okay? So the basic idea is find out what are the ground atomic sentences. And then, so the way to do that is you basically think in terms of Hildebrand base. Hildebrand base has Hildebrand universe, which is the universe of objects that you are thinking in terms of. Okay. Essentially, think of Hildebrand universe as giving all terms that can be constructed. Okay. And then Hildebrand base is take a bunch of terms and plug it into one of the predicates. That would be a ground atomic sentence. Okay? So, if in fact I have basically an MRE predicate, right? So I have a predicate of M arguments, and each of the, and then there are, I have N terms, let's say if I have N ground terms, okay, then I could put any of them in any of these places, so I can put, you know, this can be done in N times, this can be done in N different ways, this can be done in N different ways, so it's what? N power M. Okay, so there are essentially for each MRE predicate, I will wind up having N power M ground atomic sentences, each of which essentially can correspond to a proposition symbol. Okay, and then the basic idea, now of course when you're constructing terms, how do you go about constructing terms? The issue is you'll say that, you know, look at the database that you have in front of you, look at any constants that are mentioned in the database. Okay, you start with those. And then if you have only, if you have no functions, then those constants are the only terms you care about. Because any variable will have to respond, you know, basically refer to one of those constants. Those constants are the real objects in the world, right? So you start with the constants, and then if you have a function, then you basically plug in these constants into that function to generate multiple functional terms. And as we talked about last time, that number of functional terms could be infinitely long, will be infinitely large. Okay, this is one small technical tricky thing, which is, I, you know, in this particular case, in this particular case, in this particular, you know, first order logic database, what are the constants? Pat and Rao, and so those are the only constants. What are the functions? On off is the only function. Okay, so you would essentially start with two constants, and then you can keep plugging these constants into this sun off function, and then every time you do, you get a term, and now it's another constant in essence. It's another, you know, object term, and then you can keep going like this. Okay, there's one small trick that you have to keep in mind, which is that in first order logic, I might say for all x, happy x. Let's say in my database, okay, and then I would be, all I am interested in proving is prove that there doesn't exist any x that not happy x. Actually, in fact, let me make it this way, more interesting, okay. For all x, alive x implies happy x, okay. And then I would say, for all x, alive x. Okay, from this, you should be able to prove for all x, happy x. Right? Okay, now if I'm looking at this database, right now this is my only database. Are there any constants? No constants. It looks like, what do you do with for Herbrand base if there are no constants? It doesn't really matter. You can always make up, if there are no constants in the database, then you make up a constant name. Okay? And that's all you need. Okay? Just make up a constant name called A, and that's enough. And then you can start with that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? In essence, the discussion here, I assume that there are actual constants in the database. If not, make up a constant. And obviously, if there's a quantification going on, there must exist a real object. So give it a name. And then all you're doing is propositionalizing the database with respect to that name. Okay? Everything that we discuss here will hold even with that. Okay? So now you have Herbrand base, and basically, as we pointed out, the size of the Herbrand base would be exponential in the number of, exponential in the number of terms. Okay, and if the number of terms, if there's a functional symbol, there'll be infinite number of terms. Okay, but either way, given a knowledge base, you can construct a propositional version. Sometimes it's finitely large, sometimes it's infinitely large. Now, for the simple case, when it is finitely large, when the Herbrand base is finitely large, then I would say I have proved already that first order logic has semantics. Why? Basically, you took a C program, you compiled it to assembly program. Assembly program has semantics, so C program has semantics. Okay, so my first order logic database has been compiled down into a finite sized Herbrand base, which is basically equivalent to a propositional database. And you know how to prove theorems using truth tables there. So you have proved it, basically provided semantics for first order logic. So the only interesting question, of course, would be what happens if you have, what matters in that particular case is that, in fact, you can provide, using essentially a model theoretic entailment idea, you can provide a sound and complete proof procedure. Sound and complete proof procedure for for all the first order logic databases which correspond to a finite Herbrand base. Okay, so that's whole semantics point. Okay, you can be sound and complete. Okay, now what's interesting, of course, is if it's infinitely large, then the question is whether the same guarantee will hold. Okay. And that's what we were discussing towards the end of last class. If it's infinitely large, the reason it will be infinitely large in first order logic, the only way infinities can enter in first order logic is through functions. You cannot have a first order logic database with infinite number of predicates or infinite number of functional symbols or infinite number of constants. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. So the only backdoor way infinities can enter is if you have a finite number of constants and you throw in a function, you have infinite number of objects. Okay, and those are the guys that will wind up basically, those infinite number of objects power k, where k is the arity, maximum arity of the predicate, that's actually giving you trouble. Okay, so now the question, of course, is that since these are the, and then what's interesting is we found that they are function, that those terms which basically become, you have infinite number of terms now because you have a function. But you can talk about depth of the terms, okay? You can talk about the depth of a term to be the number of functional applications in it, okay? So zeroth depth terms would just be constant. Okay, one depth terms would be basically functions applied to these constants. Okay, and the two depth terms would be functions applied to this whole set above. Do you understand what I'm saying? This idea is actually called stratification. So there are actually strata of terms. Okay, lower depth terms, higher depth terms, and so on. The interesting point, of course, is I could say that I can actually say, take only terms up to depth 1 or below, up to depth 1 or below. That will only be a finite set of terms. For any finite depth, there has to be only finite set of terms because there are finite number of constants, finite number of functions. Right? Okay, so now the question, of course, is if I essentially have to, I have like a first order logic database, and if I'm trying to prove a theorem, by propositionizing it, okay, then I could try to prove the theorem up to depth k. If it is proved, then I'm done. If not, then I go k plus 1 and see if I can prove it. Prove normally means essentially take the knowledge base and the negation of the theorem that you're trying to prove and show that that column will all be false. Now, of course, notice that as you increase the depth, essentially you're not just increasing the number of terms, but you're also increasing the number of propositions. So for each depth, you have a bigger, much bigger truth table. Okay, so all that Herbrand basically pointed out is that if you can prove it if any theorem that is provable at all would be provable with a finite depth her brand base. Any theorem that's provable at all would be provable with a finite depth Herbrand base. It's a theorem, I'm not proving it, okay? This in itself is Herbrand's theorem, okay? But that gives you an idea as to why now you can be happy, because you can still prove everything that can be proven. And those theorems that cannot be proven, if there were no functional symbols, then essentially, since the truth table is finite, a theorem that cannot be proven, you will say it cannot be proven. You only have a single truth table, and you say, hey, look, there is one row where knowledge base and the theorem you're trying to prove is not becoming false. So the theorem cannot be proven. You could say that previously. But now, you know, if a theorem cannot be proven, you don't quite know. So if you are at the depth 2000 and you haven't yet proved the theorem, do you know that it won't be probable at 2001 depth? You don't know, so you have to try it. If you don't try that, and if you try that and it hasn't been proven there, then you have to go to 2002. So things that cannot be proven, you will take infinite amount of time trying to show to yourself that they can't be proven. Things that can be proven will be probable at some finite depth, and so you'll be done. Now, of course, avoid the temptation of saying, since we know it's in a finite depth, we'll only have to go to finite. Yes, finite, but what level? You don't know beforehand. You don't quite know how far you have to go to prove the theorem. So when you give up, you could have given up because you got bored, or because, in fact, the theorem, you know, even if you went forward, the theorem couldn't be proved. This is the reason why you have to essentially say that this procedure is sound and complete for all the probable theorems, but it may not terminate if you give it a theorem that cannot be proven. Okay? And that's why you would essentially say that in first order logic, at least this particular procedure essentially is semi-decidable. In the sense, when it is actually provable, there is, you know, a finite depth database from which you can prove it. When it's not provable, you will never know. Okay? So that's the difference. And if in fact there are no functions, you should not be, it shouldn't be surprising at all to you that if there are no functions in the first order logic database, then complexity of theorem proving is decidable. Okay, now why is it only decidable? Why is it not NP-hard or something? Because obviously you normally tend to think of complexity in the size of the input. But the truth table is not proportional to the size of the input. It's actually exponential in the size of the input. It becomes exponential in the number of constants, and then again becomes exponential. I'm sorry, it starts with the number of constants from this, and if there are no functions, then it's just the number of constants. But then it becomes exponential when you throw in constants into all the predicates. And it's exponential in that. Right, because when you have a huge number of propositions, then the size of the truth table is exponential in the number of propositions. Okay, so you don't say it's NP-hard anymore. It's NP-hard if you started from here, but this is already exponential in this. Okay? Question. If you understand this, you basically understand the main difference between first-order logic and propositional logic. They're very similar, but for this functional symbol. So essentially, a first-order logic database can be compiled down into an exponentially larger propositional logic database. But sometimes it will be compiled down into an infinitely large propositional database. And in that case, essentially, the theorem says that you could have compiled it into a stratified sequence of databases. You know, up to depth k plus 1, k plus 2, etc., and do theorem proving on each one of them separately, and if you can prove the theorem in any one of them, you're done. Okay?
Just without even the function, we can still have that n to the power m problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's why it's called a first, it's a more expressive language, right? In the sense, you can write a little sentence in C, and it can become this big in assembly language. Is that a bug or a feature? Right? It's a feature. Because you are saving, you know, you're able to express what you want to say in much fewer lines. And the higher the language, so in MATLAB, you can do, you know, SVD, right? The singular value decomposition of two matrices and of a matrix, as a single command, just one line. You know, then you want to write into a C program, it will be a huge big one, and which then gets compiled into assembly language, it will be even bigger one. But this is all supposed to be good, unless I am paying for your time, in which case I say, why should my employees have any life at all? They should be doing assembly language programming, right? Which is why when you graduate, most of you will be doing C++ programming. Even though programming languages have evolved a long, long way from, you know, C kind of languages, you know, if I'm paying for your time, why do I care? You know, might as well do assembly, you know, and don't have any fan in your room and, you know, sweat it out, right? That's the reason you wind up doing C language programming. Okay. So what about Gödel? So Gödel, this keeps coming up. I guess people have been asking me on the you know, emails and the blog, because I mentioned it earlier. The interesting point about Gödel's theorem is that it's only applicable, that theorem, that proof is only applicable if you essentially have a sufficiently large set of arithmetic thrown into the first order logic. Now what is the interesting part of arithmetic? You know, you can say numbers are part of arithmetic, but the really interesting part of arithmetic is mathematical induction. Okay? If a property is true for n equal to 1, and if you can show that whenever it is, if it is true for n, it would be true for n plus 1, then in essence it's true for all cases. That's what mathematical induction schema says. But this is true over all predicates. This is true over all predicates. Imagine trying to write mathematical induction schema in first order logic. The most obvious way you would think of doing it is to quantify over properties. But that's not first order. You can't quantify over properties. You can only quantify over variables. Okay? So the way first order logic is, you essentially cannot write mathematical induction schema without, you know, in a compact form. Okay, that saves you, in essence. Okay, so in fact, Gödel has both a completeness theorem and an incompleteness theorem. And in fact, for first order logic, he has a completeness theorem. And the interesting part is, the reason Gödel's incompleteness theorem is actually a huge big deal is because just about that time, mathematicians have decided that, you know, somebody says they proved something, but then later on people will find that there is a flaw in the proof. This is not going anywhere. We cannot, you know, construct house of cards. Apparently, we can construct in finance, but not in math. So they were worried about constructing house of cards. And so they, you know, Hilbert essentially said mathematicians have to have a program where they essentially automate the entire mathematics by just converting everything into logical statements, and all proofs can then be mechanically verified. Okay, you know, you don't need bozos saying, say, here's a kind of a proof, and then other bozos looking at it, because you'll now have a very syntactic procedure of checking whether the proof is correct or not. And then when Hilbert said this, you know, Russell and Whitehead and Frege, actually Gottlob Frege, were basically very much interested in axiomatizing the entire mathematics. Okay, and then the story goes that Gottlob Frege, I may not be saying his name correctly, has completed what he thought was axiomatization of mathematics. Now obviously you cannot do axiomatization of mathematics without talking about induction. He threw that in too. Okay, now he said, yeah, now I have everything axiomatized, and so obviously as long as you have a complete proof procedure, you know, rest of mathematics can be just essentially can be proved to be self-consistent. And he, you know, wrote a big book, and then as it was going up for printing, you know, Gödel sent him this little proof, basically saying that in any expressive enough system where the expressiveness starts as soon as you throw in induction over first order logic, there would be theorems that are true in that language but cannot be proven to be true in that language. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in fact, first of all, even before here, you have to understand that first order logic, when we say first order logic is complete, the completeness is only for theorems that are true. Theorems that are not true it's semi-decidable. It basically will just go on and on without being able to prove the theorem. So if in fact Gödel said, oh, first order logic is incomplete because it won't be able to say that a particular theorem is not provable, that's not surprising because we just said that even before this slide. So the only way he could have impressed us was to say, that there may be theorems that are actually true, but you still won't be able to prove that they are true. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's not a problem for first order logic. Every provable theorem is proved. Any true theorem is proved. And in Gödel's incompleteness theorem essentially shows that by construction, a certain theorem is true in his system. But there won't be any proof for showing it within the system. Okay? Which essentially meant that Frege's entire book, this thick a book, was wasted. Because there will never be an actual automated way of checking the consistency of any reasonable system. So it was a huge, huge deal at that time. And Gödel, of course, is a very interesting character. He was at Princeton Institute for Advanced Study along with Einstein and other people, and he was a famous recluse. He would barely ever talk to anybody. And at one point of time, essentially, I guess at the height of the Cold War, it was decided that he should go and apply for citizenship. You know, he was an Austrian. And you never know. I mean, somebody will say you're a communist and you'll be thrown out. And so people said, you should go take the citizenship test and pass it and then become a citizen. So he read the citizenship test booklet, and which said Constitution of United States, etc., etc. And then, of course, it says United States is a democracy. It can never be a dictatorship. And Gödel essentially proved to himself that there is a constitutional way of converting United States into dictatorship. And he wanted to, obviously, point this out to the immigration officer. Right? So basically, people hit him on the head a couple of times until he agreed not to point this out until he gets the citizenship. Because all you need is a Germanic-looking person who is a famous recluse who also points out that you guys too can be a dictatorship like just us, just back in good old Germany. Anyway, so Gödel it did change a lot in mathematics. There's an interesting issue as to whether the fact that certain theorems that are true cannot be proven to be true is a big deal for AI or not. If you're interested in that, go read the chapter on philosophical implications of AI in the textbook. Okay. So that's the deal about Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And it doesn't bite us for now at any rate because we're just first order. Okay. Any questions?
You said that we can get many, without a function, we can get many proposition statements when we actually compile it down.
Yeah.
So, but some of them will be true, false, and right.
No, that's the difference. Sorry. Again, I did not at all mean to say that you should be doing this to prove theorems in first order logic. You never proved theorems in propositional logic by drawing huge, big truth tables. So you are definitely not going to start doing that for first order logic. This was to make sure that you think before you start making ad hoc procedures, right? You want to know whether or not. So remember, in propositional logic, after the truth table, we know that there exists at least one way of computing entailment using truth tables. Then everything else, that becomes the gold standard, and everything else would be compared to it. You would say modus ponens is sound because when it says a theorem is true, it's actually true by truth table method. Modus ponens is not complete because there are theorems that the truth table method would say is a theorem, but modus ponens would not find it. Resolution is complete exactly the same way. In the sense, it would be both sound and complete because, it would not find a theorem that is not true, and it will find every theorem that is true. Okay? So this is, semantics is essentially making sure before you go ahead and draw inference, draw proof theoretic inference procedures, that there is something that you're computing, that is a meaning to what you're computing. Okay? Any other questions on this? Okay. So now we'll actually do what we will do, which is the proof theoretic computation of inference. Okay, and not surprisingly, you can do everything that you could do before. Basically, for example, you could do ground versions of everything can still be done. Okay, so for example, you can do ground mod exponents, you can do ground mod tolerance, you can do ground resolution. And when I say ground, all I mean is that if it is true, if I have PAB or QCD, where ABCD are constants, and then I have not PAB or MCD, then basically you realize that once they are ground, they're just proposition symbols with an extra parenthesis and comma hanging around. Okay, so you know that this and this can be resolved away and you can get QCD or MCD. So every ground inference in proposition logic can be done here too. Okay, by the way, this will also work if in fact this being PAB, suppose I had PAFB and PAFB, where F is a function. It doesn't matter. The fact that there's a function doesn't matter. It's still a propositional symbol. So the only thing that you need to figure out how to deal with is what? Variables and quantification. Okay, so what do variables and quantification bring in? In essence, variables and quantification, I mean, variables go with quantification, right? And then quantification, there are two types. One is a huge big conjunction. Universal quantification is a huge big conjunction. Universe and existential is a huge big disjunction. Okay, so all I would say is basically just say that. Okay, so whenever I have a quantified sentence in my knowledge base, I can instantiate it for any constant in my knowledge base. I can just go ahead and, so for example, if I know for all x and for all y, p of xy implies q of x. This is a statement in my knowledge base. I can go ahead and write p of ab implies q of a if a and b are constants in my knowledge base. Right? That's what you always thought. Okay? And similarly, now, so if forget about this for a minute. So now if you have this, right? So this essential first for all became a ground term. Now this ground sentence with another ground sentence can be combined using propositional inference rules. So now we are back into normal way of doing things. So you get rid of the appending one, which is this quantifier, by instantiating. Okay. Now, of course, there is so keep that in mind. So the other one, of course, is there exists x p of x. Okay, there exists x p of x. You can always write there exists x p of x to be entailing P of SK1, or SK1 is a brand new constant, which doesn't currently exist in the database. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, if it's an existential, that means there must be somebody for whom it's true. Now, the temptation is to take somebody you know and say it must be true for that person. But that's not allowed. It's true for some object, and I don't know which of these is the object. So that's why you normally are supposed to put a huge big disjunction. You could do that. You could extend it and write a disjunction. The point, of course, is that you could also say that as far as meaning is concerned, you can make up a new constant and say it's true for that constant. Okay? And that's basically called existential instantiation. So an existential statement can be instantiated by essentially putting a constant which doesn't exist in the database. And a universal can be instantiated by substituting constants that exist in the database. Okay? Fine. So now once I have this, I can essentially do universal instantiation or existential instantiation to get ground sentences, and then convert them into causal form or whichever form I want, and do ground propositional reasoning using either resolution or mod exponents. Okay, so that's one way already, and this does not require you to draw a huge big truth table. Okay, so let's look at that. So here is actually these two, universal instantiation, existential instantiation. Here is a more technical slide which actually shows what you're doing. Every instantiation of a universally quantified sentence is essentially entailed by it. Okay, and for any sentence alpha and variable v and a constant symbol k that does not appear elsewhere in the knowledge base, you can always take there exists v alpha and say it's true for that particular constant. Okay, and you have to make sure that you understand that there is somebody. Suppose I said there is somebody who is going to get an A plus in this class, right? And when I scholarize that, I need to give a name. And you're all eagerly looking to see, is it me, is it me, is it me? Or maybe, whatever, right? So the question is, I can always scholarize it by saying, the A plus getting student will get the A plus. I removed the existential, and I made a name for this student who's going to get A plus. I call this person A plus getting student. Did I violate any rules? No. Are you any better off than before? No. Okay, you are better off than before in a following sense. Previously, if you didn't know what to do with this statement that I gave you, that there exists somebody who's going to get an A plus in this class, now you know that there must exist an actual constant which will get A plus. And if I then tell you that, prove that it's not the case that everybody will get a grade less than A plus, you can prove it, because you see, here's a counterexample. This A plus getting student is going to get A plus. You don't know who it is, I don't know who it is, but we all know they exist. And by putting that existential, I have essentially guaranteed that at least one person will get A plus. So your knowledge increased. That's what scholarization does. Okay? And then what is another interesting thing is, technically, when you instantiate a universally quantified assertion into ground assertions, you don't change the meaning of the knowledge base at all. When you do the existential instantiation, actually the resulting database is no longer actually equivalent for the original database. Because now I just made up this guy, this person called A plus getting student, which didn't exist in the previous database. However, it has the property that every theorem that is provable in one is provable in the other, and vice versa. So they are proof-wise equivalent. Okay? Fine. So I will now, when I cross over from this slide, for a while I'll forget existential quantification. Okay? Here's the interesting thing. If I forget existential quantification, I'll basically be looking at universal quantification, and there are two inference procedures we looked at when propositional reasoning. Which were those? Two proof theoretic inference procedures that we looked at, with some interest. The resolution, which is complete and sound, but before that we looked at something else. Mod exponents. Of course, there are mod exponents and all that stuff, but mod exponents is a very useful thing. And what was the technical result about mod exponents? Mod exponents is not complete, right? But it's complete for some kind of things. Horn clauses. Okay? Mod exponents is complete for Horn clauses. In fact, a definite clause, so a Horn clause is what? If you were to convert that clause, that sentence into a clausal form, it will have what? At most one positive, at most one positive literal, which means it can have 0 or 1. Okay? And a subset of Horn clauses are definite clauses. A definite clause essentially is a Horn clause where there is no more uncertainty as to how many positive literals are going to be there. Definitely one. Okay? Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's a Hahn class where there's exactly one positive literal. The reason those are interesting, if you think about it, suppose you have not P or not Q or S. Is that a definite class? Yeah? You can, I say, write this as P and Q implies S. This is the normal implications you know and love. Okay? And if you ever thought of, how many of you have seen prologue in your life? Okay? So, this is nothing but S if P or Q. Okay? So, basically, what we're going to learn in learning, and so this is a simple, if you have statements of this form, and of the form is, you know, suppose I have P and Q, P and Q. This is definite class, right? Is this a definite class? Yes or no?
Yes.
How about this? Yes. If you add these, I can now actually prove S. Just by what? Mod exponents. If you have definite clauses, in fact, mod exponents is complete for Hahn clauses, but the part of Hahn clauses that you really oftentimes are interested in is the definite clauses. So you tend to say, I have a bunch of rules saying if this and this and this are true, this will be true. Okay? And I'll know something about this is true, and then I'll put all this together and show S is true. So mod exponents can be used on, you know, a subset of first order logic knowledge base. That's all definite classes. So if you know only, if all you know is definite classes, then you can use mod exponents. Okay. Now, in propositional logic itself, there are cases where what you know about the world can be written as definite classes. Okay. Now that you come to first order logic, one of the interesting questions which I haven't explained to you is how do these clauses look like in first order logic? How do these clauses look like in first order logic? Okay. In particular, what happens is in first order logic, each of these are going to be atomic sentences or negations of atomic sentences. So, you know, I would have not P, X, Y, R, not Q, Y, Z, R, M, X, Z. Okay? And of course, instead of variables, I can also have constants. So that's how the clauses would look like. We'll show you in a minute that, you know, that when you, there is a way of converting every first order logic knowledge base into a form like that. That would be the CNF form for first order logic. Now, if you could say a bunch of things with just mod exponents, like, I mean, the definite clauses in propositional logic, then there are even more situations where you can get by just with mod exponents in first order logic. And in some sense, the fact that Prolog exists and the fact that your project 4 exists is a good indication of that. That many a time, what you know about the world can be written as Hahn clauses in first order logic. And so for that, if you just know how to do mod exponents, you're enough. Okay? Fine. So now what's wrong with, now basically having said all that, now we already have a way of doing mod exponents in first order logic, right? Which is if I have this for all x, king x and greedy x implies evil x, and if I know King John, and then for all y, greedy y is true, and brother Richard John, these are true. Okay. Now, based on this, can you say King John is evil? John is evil. Can you prove that John is evil? Yeah? How do you go about proving it? Until now, what I told you is you take every one of these first order quantified sentences, write down arbitrarily some instantiations corresponding to the constants in the world, and then try to do mod exponents. Here itself, you have Richard as well as John, two constants. So I would, for example, write this as King Richard and Greedy Richard implies evil Richard. King John and Greedy John implies evil John. And then one of them winds up being enough to prove my theorem. I'm not saying you won't be able to prove the theorem, but the question is at what cost? Imagine you had 10,000 objects. You'd have written, without knowing where you're going, you'd have written 10,000 instantiations of the universal. And then look for which would be useful. And I throw in a function, you're dead. Right? So the point, of course, is can I just instantiate, can I just come up with the instantiation that's actually going to be useful for my theorem? As against generating all instantiations. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm not saying that King Richard and Greedy Richard implies evil Richard is not a sentence. It is a sentence. But it's a wasted sentence. I don't need to write it down during my theorem proving. Okay, think about it the following way. One of the things that you want to understand actually when you come up to this point is if you were to write this down as one verse, one for John and one for Richard, and then do what I said, which is then do ground propositional inference, then up to that point, the metaphor of C language programs are written by you, but the compiler converts into a huge, big assembly language program, and Intel is the theorem prover for the assembly language program. That's all taken care of. That's correct. What we're doing for now is I don't want to actually compile the entire first-order logic database into a huge part where only a small piece is actually needed. Do you understand what I'm saying? Even in C, even in impoverished languages like C, sometimes there are situations where I think you could write this whole part doesn't need to be compiled if your machine happens to be a Sun operating system. And this whole part doesn't need to be compiled if this your machine happens to be a Windows operating system. So you only compile the part that's actually relevant. Okay? To some extent, that's what I'm going to do now. I'm going to actually generate only those ground instances that are relevant in proving my theorem. That's what I want to do. Okay? There's nothing wrong with the previous version. If there are no function symbols, if there are function symbols, there is something wrong with it because you will wind up writing infinitely large compilation. Okay? But you can be more efficient even without function symbols if you can do the reasoning at the higher order, at the first order level, without first completely grounding it. Okay? Now, whatever you are hearing in this slide will start coming back to you in multiple other times when you go to probabilistic reasoning. For example, people keep talking about lifted inference for first order, you know, probabilistic models. And what they mean essentially is don't compile it down completely. If you compile it down completely, all you fooled is the user who gets to write a small program, but as soon as it's done that side, you very quickly compile it down to a huge big assembly language program. Doing inference without compilation can be much more efficient, or essentially compiling just the part that would be needed to solve your theorem would be much more efficient. Okay? To do that, essentially what you need to do is, if I am trying to prove evil John, in essence I need to realize that, you know, here is the basic idea, evil John, and the only guy here which can give me evil John is this. It gives me evil X. How can I make evil X be evil John? Well, set X equal to John, it'll become evil John. Now then, of course, I'll go and propagate this here. And then I have to prove to myself King John and Greedy John. Now, is King John true? Yeah, it's true. Now, is Greedy John true? No, it is not directly true, but the only guy who can give me Greedy John is this guy, Greedy Y. If you set y equal to John, it will be true. So this way, in essence, dynamically, I picked exactly the bindings that will allow me to complete my theorem. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, I could not have done this if this was there exists y. Right? If I said there exists y, greedy y, and I wanted to prove greedy John, I can't say, oh, somebody is greedy, let John be greedy. That's saying let world be so nice that my theorem will be done. Right? You don't get to do that. This, on the other hand, everybody is greedy because it's for all. So since you don't mind everybody being greedy, why not you let me make John greedy? And I'm not asking you too much. Okay, this process, this is a very simple process, but it has a beautiful name called unification. Okay, so when you are doing first order inference, normally what you would wind up doing is you try to, in this particular case, you're trying to prove evil John, you unified evil John with evil X, you got X equal to John, you propagated into this, you then got King John and Greedy John, and then you try to prove them recursively. What I just did tell right in front of you is called backward chaining with unification. Okay, in propositional reasoning, you are doing unification, except if the unifier will either be yes, it exists, or no, it won't exist. Because, you know, if I said Greedy Tom, and you're trying to prove Greedy John, it won't be unified. You can't say John is Tom, right? Do you understand what I'm saying? So there are some rules in unification. You know, it's not just a mapping of names. You're only allowed to map variables to terms. Variables to terms, ground terms, ultimately ground terms, but variables to terms. Okay? So here are some examples. Okay? Knows John X, knows John Jane. Can they be unified? Can they be made equal? Yes, right? What do I need to do? I said X equal to Jn, and it'll be fine. So anytime you have a unification, there is a unifier. A unifier is essentially a mapping. Okay? So for the first one, the mapping basically is X is mapped to Jn. That's the unifier. Okay. How about the next? Knows John X, knows Y OJ. Can they be made equal? Yes. Okay. So I can basically say X is going to be mapped to OJ, and John, I'm sorry, and then Y is going to be mapped to John, right? Y is going to be mapped to John. Okay, fine. Now, before I do the third one, I'll put in one new one. Can those be unified? Knows X Rav, knows Y Rav. Can they be unified? Can they be made equal? Why not? Remember, one of the interesting things is, if there is a variable left at all, in essence, we are already kind of realizing that if there is no other quantification and variables are left, then they are universal variables. So this must have come from something which says everybody knows Rao, or Rao knows everybody, whichever you want, you know, feel. And then the same way, it's again saying the same thing. Now the question is, are these unifiable? Yes, no? Yes, they can be unified. Now tell me some unifications. I would say X Tom, Y Tom will unify these. Yes or no? Yes. Is that a good unifier to go with? Basically, remember where you are using unifiers. At some point of time, you are trying to prove some theorem, okay, and you try to unify it with a head. Now, what I want to concede is the minimum I can concede so that I can move on. Do you understand what I'm saying? I want to concede the minimum so that I can move on, and here I'm conceding too much. All I needed to say is X is the same as Y. and I made them equal by saying x is term and y is term, which is unnecessarily specialized. There's nothing wrong with it, but this is going to be not going to help you in completely proving the theorem. You may have to come back and try x equal to Mary, y equal to Mary. Okay? So instead, you want to say x is mapped to y. Okay? Now this is a unifier. This is a unifier. What's the difference between them? One is a more general unifier than the other. And in particular, you are interested in computing the maximal general unifier. Do the least amount of concession to get by. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, that's the whole point. Do the least amount of concession to get by, and that would be done in the unification by ensuring that you only compute the maximally general unification. Okay, and these two cases, of course, the only unification you thought about is also maximally general, but this one it wasn't the case. Okay, and the only thing that you can say about a unifier is always x mapped to a term. X is a variable mapped to a term. Variable mapped to a term. Variable mapped to a term. So I didn't say anything wrong. I mean, I didn't change any rules. Okay? So how about the last, next one? Knows John X, knows Y, mother Y. In fact, now I actually can give you an algorithm for doing this. Okay? I can give you an algorithm for doing this, which is basically I will write knows John X, knows Y, mother Y. Right? That's what I'm trying to prove. That's what I'm trying to unify. Okay? Here is an algorithm. First, check if the length of these two is the same. If it's not, they can't be unified. Did you understand what I'm saying? If I have one term which has more, basically, if you look at this as a list, it would be nose, term, term. Nose, term, term. So both are length 3. So you can actually unify. Then go ahead and check that the variable names are the same. If the variable's names are not the same, then you can't unify them. Okay? So now I started with my, basically think of it as I have a pointer in the beginning, and then I now move the pointer up to here. This much has been unified. Now I have to unify John to Y. How can I unify John to Y? If one of them is a variable, then make that variable to be the other term. Okay? So I would say when I came up to this point, my unifier, my partial unifier till now is Y is John. That's my partial unifier. So I get to now move beyond John up to here, and I'm trying to essentially unify X and mother Y. But not really, because the commitments I made in making up to this unify have to be propagated. Okay, so I take Y equal to John, and then substituting to the rest of this expression, it will not change because Y is the only thing that's changing, X is not, so it will still be X. And I substitute also here, and I would get mother John. Right? Now, I ask myself, can they be unified? They can be if one of them is a variable. If one of them is a variable, then you can say that is mapped to the other thing. So now I can say X is mapped to mother John. So my total unifier is Y is mapped to John, X is mapped to mother John. That's the algorithm, by the way. And in project 4, normally you should write this code, I give you free. Okay, I give you the unifier code and it does it for you, and you can look at it and see that it does it. Okay? And so that's that. And then how about this? Knows John X, knows X OJ. Why is this failing? If you do the same thing as I said, By the time you came up to here, John is equal to, X is mapped to be John. Once you map X equal to John, this will be John and OJ. And John and OJ are two constants. You can't make them equal. That's why it fails. That's a very good point. So the question ultimately is this X really supposed to be, so if in fact they were part of the same sentence and the same X is supposed to be there in both of them, you shouldn't allow them to be unified. If not, you should basically allow them to be unified, right? To do that, one thing you can do is before you start unification, you standardize variables apart. You standardize variables apart. Okay? For every quantifier, so I can say for all X loves X, for all X hates X. Okay? But these are two different X's really. So I would then say for all X1 loves X1, for all X2 hates X2. That's what is called standardizing variables apart, and that exactly solves your problem. Okay? Exactly. You just separate them apart. Now, for example, when you were doing it, you would not have been able to standardize it this way. Suppose I said, for all X, loves X means won't kill X. I'm sort of an optimist. Okay? Right? Suppose that's what I said. Right? Now, when you are trying to standardize it, you don't get to say, loves X1 implies won't kill X2. You don't get to say that, because this is the same variable here. So these will all be X1s, let's say, and then a different statement, it will be X2. And once you do that, by the time you come here, everything is supposed to be standardized, and so if they're still the same, that means they're supposed to be the same. That's why standardizing apart eliminates overlap of variables. What? Alpha and beta are two different statement. This is alpha, this is beta. Okay? Now there is one other tricky situation that is that you need to consider, okay, which is knows X f of X, okay, and knows u. The question is whether these two unify or not. Okay, let's see what our procedure says. I go up to here, I will essentially say X is mapped to U, or U is mapped to X, whichever is fine. The moment I say X is mapped to U, then this will become F of U, and this will become F of U. Okay? Yeah. No, wait. No, X is mapped to U. No, this is not U. This is just U, right? See, F of X, so X is mapped to U, so this becomes F of U. U is not changed, so this will still be U. So I can make these two equal by saying U is mapped to F of U. Seems like it's okay, right? U is a variable, F of U is a term. But that's an infinite regress. If U is mapped to F of U, then the U inside F of U is mapped to another F of U. So U is really mapped to F of U. So in essence, U cannot be mapped to a function of yourself. Do you understand? Because it semantically makes no sense for U to be mapped to F of U. U can be mapped to F of G, where G is a variable. And the way you stop this kind of a thing is, since it's still a variable and this is a term and you're about to make the mapping, you will say, no, I won't do it because U occurs in this term. A term cannot be mapped, a variable cannot be mapped to a term in which that variable occurs, because then it will be an infinite regress. Okay? This is actually called occurs check. And if you don't do occurs check, essentially you get nonsensical unification sometimes. Okay? And you know, it's not that hard to do. You can just put one more extra statement doing occurs check. What's interesting, of course, is if I give you two expressions and I'm trying to unify them, right? What's the complexity of unification? Turns out, the moment you throw in a curse check, the complexity changes. It's easy to do, but it makes a difference because you have to backtrack multiple times and consider other unifiers. Okay? And so, many implementations go ahead and not do a curse check. Like Prolog, many implementations of Prolog, which really works by this, doesn't do a curse check. Makes no sense for it not to do a curse check, but it just wings it, in essence. Okay? So, with this on our back, with the unification, knowledge of unification, you know, on our side, we can then essentially say that I can always do something called a generalized Morris ponens. A generalized Morris ponens says, if I have P1 dash, P2 dash, etc., Pn dash are all true in my knowledge base, and if I know that P1 and P2, etc., up to Pn implies Q, then I can go ahead and write Q of theta, that is Q substituted with theta. With theta is a unifier. If in fact it is the case that for the unifier theta, this whole thing applied to this whole thing with theta applied to them will be the same as this whole thing with theta applied to them. Okay? That's all. Okay, so all I am basically saying now is this will give us exactly the thing that we needed. If I said for all x, P of x implies Q of x, and Q and P of Rav I can write Q of x with x substituted with Rav, because for the same substitution x substituted with Rav, this is the same, and the same substitution here, P Rav with x substituted with Rav will remain the P Rav and P Rav is equal. And so I get to write this. Something that's intuitively obvious to you, I just went through this idea of mapping, which is unification. Okay? Now comes the fun part, which we will start today, and you know, you will get to think about it more, and then next time we'll again look at it if needed. Okay? So if I have this, and if I already gave you a unifier, which basically can compute unifications, right, then I say that you can do pretty heavy duty theorem proving with generalized Morris ponens. Okay? So for example, here is a bunch of knowledge and I wrote it down like this. Okay? And I am trying to see if there is an apartment pet. Now the question of course is, how do I prove, how do I look for that proof? You know, I need to make some conventions. The conventions I'll make is, I'm trying to look for apartment pet X, right? I will always start looking at my knowledge base top to bottom, left to right. That's my convention. Okay? So what I would do, and then in each of these, basically these are called heads. Because this is tail, this is head. Okay? I will look for, in trying to prove a theorem, I look for, start from the top, look for the first guy whose head will unify with what I'm trying to prove. If it unifies, then I substitute that unification into the tail. Okay, so suppose I'm trying to prove that there is an apartment pet X, then I can say, well, this, you know, in fact, remember that before I come here, I should do what he said, which is I should standardize all variables. So this would be X1, this would be X2, X3, etc., after this is X1000. Okay, so I'm trying to see whether apartment pet X1000 exists. By the way, here's an interesting thing. All the x's up to here are universally quantified. Okay? This x here, is it universally quantified or existentially quantified? Essentially existentially quantified. Does that make a difference? It doesn't. Why? Because the theorem you're trying to prove, the theorem you're trying to prove is there exists x apartment pet X. That's the theorem you're trying to prove. But how will you prove it if you're using resolution refutation? You take the negation of it. Right? Right? So if you take the negation of it, it'll become for all X, not apartment pet X. And I try to find a counterexample for this. And every counterexample is a proof for the theorem. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it looks as if I'm sort of throwing in existentials, but they are not, because existential in the query is universal in the proof. So in Prolog, all queries are existential queries. In fact, the opposite would be harder. To say, I cannot ask a query in generalized modus ponens that to prove that this holds for everybody, because then that will become an existential after conversion. Cute? As long as you remember how things are going on, you know, it all makes sense. Okay, so apartment pet X, I go there, and then I'll say, I mean, that would be, I can prove it if I can prove something is small and something is pet. And that same thing is pet. Okay, let's look at this picture. So what I did was, to prove apartment pet X, I said, well, this, I can use this, and then I will get apartment pet of an X if I can prove that same X is small and pet. So in essence, I have now two sub-goals, small X and pet X. Whenever I have two sub-goals to prove, I will try to prove them left to right. Okay, so let me prove the left one, small X. I'm now trying to prove small X on the same database. So I recursively call myself. Look for anybody who gets to tell me smallness. With my luck, the first guy who says, I'll prove small X, says, yeah, I'll prove small X, you give me a skunk. Okay? So I proved small X using rule 5, and now I just have to make sure that this X dash is a skunk. Now I need to prove that there exists a skunk. So I go down in the database looking for somebody who has skunk in their head. This basically is no tail, all head. Right? True implies skunk Louis. That's what this is. So I take skunk Louis, which will unify. In fact, this is the first non-trivial unification. Okay? And then it will unify, and I only need to prove true. True is trivially true. So at this point, I have proved this theorem, and I say as long as X dash is Louis, I have something that's small. Now the sideways information goes, and then I have to make sure that this X dash here has to be the same guy. So now I have to prove pet Louis. So I try to prove pet Louis. I try to prove pet Louis by using this and see if Louis is an elephant. That's not, no, first I'll try to prove it by saying that it's a dog. It's not a dog. Then I try to prove it by saying it's a cat. It's not a cat. Then I try to prove it by saying it's an elephant. It's not an elephant. So I couldn't prove that Louis is a pet. So I go back here and then continue going down in the thing and look for a different way of proving the last theorem I proved. And I keep doing chronological backtracking. Okay? And then I go down and then I pass. So this thing is sideways information passing. This is what your code is going to do. Stare at this. Make sure you understand this. Ask me questions next time.